The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening today. This hour, as the U.S. and the world focus on the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, Afghanistan slides back into war. Six U.S. soldiers were killed this week in a suicide attack near Bagram in Afghanistan.
There have been very low casualties for a very long time, and that this constitutes really quite a significant event precisely because we're not used to it and haven't seen anything like it for some time.
That's Nicholas Haysom, the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan, speaking at the U.N. earlier this week. Meanwhile, the Taliban seems poised to take over the city of Sangin, where coalition forces fought some of their deadliest battles. In the last decade, dozens of Marines died fighting for the city in Helmand, along with hundreds of British soldiers. A surge of troops in 2010 brought some hard-earned calm to the area, but peace proved fleeting there. Now, with coalition troops gone, conflict has moved in again, just months after a Taliban offensive briefly took over the northern city of Kunduz. But author Mike Martin says the entire focus on the Taliban misses a key truth in Afghanistan. Mike Martin served in Helmand. He was there as a British military officer. He's also author of An Intimate War, An Oral History of the Helmand Conflict. And he says what Westerners are told is a war with the Taliban isn't the Taliban at all.
What's really been happening with the, you know, if I put the word Taliban in inverted commas, is there's a bit of a shifting mosaic, and people leave, people join. Often the reason people are fighting is because of land or water or blood feuds or honour or so on and so forth. And what the Taliban Shura in Quetta, which is just over the border in Pakistan, did is they provided legitimacy to a whole bunch of different people that were fighting for different reasons. And in some cases, they provided funding. Although more often than not, the people in Helmand province who were fighting, British troops and American troops, were self-funding through poppy or smuggling or various other things.
Then given the difference between an organized Taliban and just sort of a branded Taliban, is there a direct connection between what we're seeing in Helmand province and, say, the conflict several months ago when Taliban forces briefly overtook Kunduz? Is that the same organization or, again, just a matter of semantics?
If I were just to take one district in Helmand and I wanted to aggregate all the different conflicts and fights in that district, it would be very hard to design one framework that would fit all those conflicts in, because some would be about water, some would be about the fact that British soldiers have killed their relative or so on and so forth. To aggregate the conflicts in Helmand and in Kunduz, I think is ridiculous. So to take Kunduz, for instance, up there you have a large Pashtun immigrant community who was settled there in the 1800s by an Afghan king called Abdul Rahman. That's created community tension, effectively between the natives, the guys who were there before the 1880s, and the Pashtun communities who were transported from the south and the east. So that conflict and all the sub-conflicts that make it up are overlaid with this government Taliban narrative. Go to Helmand. Well, let's have a look at Sangin, which is why we're talking today. I could talk you through a long history of that, but you know, let's just pick three things. We've got the district boundaries drawn in 1964 that were basically gerrymandered to bring together a weird collection of tribes. You've got a drugs war going on between two of the main tribes, the Alakazai and the Ishaqzai. And then you've got water issues stretching up the Sangin Valley up towards the Kajaki Dam. And you've got access to irrigation water and believe it or not, flood protection. And so you've got all of these issues, and then a whole bunch of clans and tribes jockeying around these issues. Add on to that, you know, all the layers of conflict from American soldiers being there, British soldiers being there, feuds, so on and so forth. It's almost impossible to overlay a binary dichotomy on it. This is much, much, much more complicated. And to overlay a simple black, white, good, bad Taliban government dichotomous narrative over it is to court failure, because everyone realizes that that's how you interpret the conflict, and all the Helmandis will come up to you and all the information they give you will be given to you within that framework. And so when they say to you, ah, yes, Mike, the Taliban are all the way over there, and this happened, this, you know, this personal experience happened to me all the time, Mike, the Taliban are over there, what they actually meant was, that village over there is a village that we've been having a feud with for the last 50 years. And would you mind please going and attacking it? This happened all the time.
Well, then, Mike Martin, if that's the case, and we're looking at a mosaic of localized, regionalized conflicts in many ways, that then raises the question to me about whether this is really the concern of British soldiers or American soldiers or NATO. Certainly, we want a stable and peaceful Afghanistan because we don't want the next Al-Qaeda to rise up there. But if it's a water issue at the dam or a local tribal issue, I'm not sure that that's our concern.
How a Special Operations Force is going to help. So let's break a few myths, shall we? One of the myths that's often bandied about is that Western troops are good at stabilizing, you just use the word yourself, stabilizing countries. Right. I would like to propose that Western military forces are not very good at stabilizing Muslim tribal societies. All the evidence of the last 15 years shows that we are actually awful at it. And if you ask most Helmandis, they'll tell you that it's the Westerners who bring the instability. To go back to your point more directly, absolutely, you know, stable, prosperous Afghanistan is in everyone's favor. It's in our favor, it's in their favor. The question is, when you've had a civil war going on for 40 years, adding resources, be they development resources or military resources, it's just like pouring petrol onto a smoldering fire. Arguably, the best thing you could do is to leave that well alone and convince the neighboring countries also to leave it well alone. Sure, you allow in humanitarian stuff, but weaponry, money, development project, these sorts of things aggravate the conflict, because if you pour resources into a political situation that you don't understand, people jockey and they fight for those resources and it makes it more unstable. This is exactly what's going to happen in Sangin.
Mike Martin, this is a dose of reality about the conflict in Afghanistan that I don't think most Americans have heard, and I thank you for giving it to us. Mike Martin is author of An Intimate War, An Oral History of the Helmand Conflict. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
So as the conflict in Helmand continues, a new investigation looks at the money behind the madness in Afghanistan, a country teetering still on the brink of disaster.
It faces a lot of difficulties. The biggest one is security. No one's going to invest if you're being shot at. The second difficult situation you're dealing with is the corruption. A serious problem. Nobody's going to invest faced with such endemic corruption.
That's John Sopko. He's Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. He was talking with The Takeaway back in October. Sopko's reports formed the basis of a new investigation by Megan McCloskey. She's defense reporter for ProPublica. McCloskey looked at rebuilding efforts in Afghanistan into the billions of dollars the U.S. has wasted there, often to little effect.
Well, the total that we found in questionable spending is $17 billion, and it covers everything from about 2009 on, and it could be roads, buildings, schools, hospitals, also quite a bit of money that has gone into building the Afghan army and police, training their buildings, their equipment like helicopters.
But also things as deep as anti-drug efforts, poppy eradication, giving Afghanistan sort of a financial alternative to the drugs trade, all of these things.
Sure. Yeah, we put $8.4 billion into countering narcotics in Afghanistan and trying to get them to grow legal crops. Afghanistan is the world leader in poppy production. They grow more poppy than they did before the war.
Now, as you said, we could be talking about schools, we could be talking about buildings. Let's talk about roads, because it seems like roads is a ubiquitous problem that has really turned into a boondoggle. What's going on with American money for Afghan roads?
We have sunk $2.4 billion into roads in Afghanistan, both to build them and to maintain them. And there's a bunch of problems. One, there is an active insurgency, and so every time we build a road, it often gets blown up again. It's also expensive to maintain asphalt. Like if you are just driving around in the U.S., we have lots of potholes and we have a pretty good infrastructure. So you can imagine in a country like Afghanistan that doesn't have the kind of tax base that we do to pay for construction, they simply can't afford to keep up the roads. So we have put a lot of money into building them, and then they're falling apart. The UN says 85% of Afghanistan roads are undrivable.
So as we pour this $2.5 billion into roads, it seems like there's also either an Afghan unwillingness or inability to do that maintenance, quite apart from a war situation, just normal wear and tear. It seems like we've paved all these things with no plan to keep them paved.
Absolutely. That's a problem throughout our efforts in reconstruction. We pay no attention to sustainability, long-term upkeep. We had very grand plans building this first world infrastructure, but Afghanistan doesn't have the funds, doesn't have the technical expertise to maintain roads, to maintain the buildings. We'll build a school that'll have some complex heating system that the Afghans don't know how to do and is too expensive to keep up. And you see this over and over again.
So what's the issue here at home? What's the issue in the Pentagon and the State Department and USAID? Is this a wartime culture that says the military gets what it wants and we're not going to look over their shoulder because it's wartime? And if the general wants to build a road, the general can build a road. Is it as simple as that? Or is it some more systemic lack of accountability that's going on here?
I think it's both. And certainly in a wartime situation, the military gets a very long leash and billions, if not trillions of dollars to spend how it wants. And there is also a cultural lack of accountability on these projects. You don't see anybody who is held accountable for blowing $500 million on planes that we could never really get off the ground because there weren't enough spare parts. And so 20 planes were scrapped for metal. And that just happens, and nobody is ever held responsible. Then there's also this issue of the military being in the lead for reconstruction. They spent most of the money. They were the ones who had the most people on the ground. And they had a very large hearts and mind campaign and thought that they would be able to buy peace and prosperity. And nobody has really challenged that strategy at home, and USAID and state have kind of had to go along with it. But we really haven't seen any sort of public reckoning of if this was a good idea.
So this raises the question then whether we're just talking about kind of standard political waste, bad accounting, no quality control, no follow through, or if this is really about the folly of nation building itself. Those are two separate questions. Which of those things is it?
The bigger issue is the folly of nation building, whether or not you can do that successfully. And I actually asked that question to almost everyone I talked to, generals, ambassadors. And I said, is the lesson that we've learned from all this is that we're just really bad at nation building? Maybe we shouldn't do it anymore. And all of them said yes, but that inevitably we will probably do it again. And so then the question becomes, maybe it needs to be done better. And how do you do it better? And then that's answering the question of accountability and systemic waste and having some sort of structure that really does reconstruction as a whole instead of piecemeal.
$17 billion spent on what you call waste in the story leads me to believe, in fact, to know that it's not just money wasted. Somebody got very, very rich off of all this construction. Who is making all of the billions that are being spent? Is the army building these roads themselves, or do we have contractors who are in Afghanistan making out with all of this American largesse?
We have contractors making a lot of money, and not just contractors. We have consultants. Almost every project seems to have an additional firm that's consulting on it. And there are some cases where the army's doing the building. They have the U.S. Corps of Army Engineers. But for the most part, particularly with USAID projects, it's all contractors and it's all American contractors. And they get a very large sum of money. And then they subcontract out the work to Afghan contractors on the ground. So quite a bit of this reconstruction money has come home.
An estimated $17 billion wasted on construction, on training, on the Iraqi army, on drug eradication in Afghanistan. Is anyone paying attention? Has anyone learned a lesson? Has Congress? Has the military? Megan McCloskey of ProPublica says probably not. Megan McCloskey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry today. That data breach that allowed the campaign staff from the Bernie Sanders campaign to briefly view Hillary Clinton's campaign data, that was quickly tidied up over the weekend, although the Sanders campaign says he's still going ahead with a lawsuit over the matter. There was a lot of bluster, but the episode did expose one thing that most Americans probably don't know about modern political campaigns, and that's just how much data campaigns have about you. Or at least about their supporters. You know, just like retailers, credit card companies, maybe even the NSA use big data to guess how and where you're likely to behave, campaigns are doing the same thing with millions of voters. The intersection between data and politics was largely glamorized by the 2008 campaign of then political unknown Barack Obama. Ethan Roeder became the national data director for the Obama campaign in 2008 and served in the same role in 2012. And he joins me now. Ethan, welcome.
Good to be here.
Ethan, what exactly does the modern presidential campaign know about its supporters, about voters?
Well, modern campaigns have access to what's called a voter file, and that includes information about 250 million people in the United States. These files are actually all created and maintained at the state level, so there are different formats in different states and different degrees of access to information. Some states, for instance, will tell you the gender, the age, the race of all of the individuals that are registered to vote. Other states might give you a more limited range of data.
Now, that's the voter file, but campaigns themselves also have a lot of information on anyone who's interacted with them, right? Whether they be a volunteer or a prospective volunteer or somebody who's donated $5, that's a separate bunch of data, and that's important too.
That's right. In fact, the most valuable information that any campaign has access to is not information that comes from the voter file or that they purchase through consumer data vendors. It's actually what they learn by engaging voters directly, having conversations with voters. That information becomes the most valuable information that campaigns have to work with.
And what makes the data so valuable?
In addition to what we call voter ID, which is basically what candidate would a particular voter support. In addition to that information, information about contribution history, whether or not people give online or they give through a text message program or they give by going to the website and entering their credit card information. Again, those are things that would be proprietary to the campaign and incredibly important and valuable. Now there's no indication, just to be clear, that any of that type of information was exposed through this breach.
Nevertheless, do you think that the average voter would be alarmed or at least concerned if they knew how much modern campaigns actually knew about them? I mean, I expect Visa to know when I buy anything anywhere. I don't expect candidate X to know that much about me.
It's a good question, and I don't know what the how the average voter might react to seeing the scope of information that campaigns have access to. Frankly, much of it does come from public sources. In fact, if you want to spook out your friends, you can Google Ohio voter file, and you can go download the entire Ohio voter database right now. It's freely publicly available on the internet. Now, that's not the case for all states, but one of the interesting aspects of this for me is when I talk to my counterparts in European countries, they're mortified by the scope of information that campaigns in the United States have access to. And in fact, we see that across a number of different areas in the United States. It's not just what information campaigns have access to, but indeed it is consumer information. It's what information the government makes use of and how. The United States is a place where those kinds of privacy issues tend to be much further towards providing open access to information, even at the individual level, especially when you compare it to some of the European countries.
All right, so let's play campaign dress up just for one second. Let's pretend, just for the sake of argument, that I voted for Hillary Clinton in the primary in 2008 when she ran against Barack Obama, and I had a phone conversation with an intern who was doing phone banking at the time, and I said to them, yeah, I'm probably going to vote, but I'll try to get out there by 7 p.m. I got three kids, and I support her, but I'm going to try to vote. I'll do my best. So now, what do they know when they call me? What does that mean to the campaign now?
The first thing to note is that approximately 14% of the U.S. population moves every year. So in the 4 years that separate one presidential election from another, anywhere from 30 to 40% of the voters that you're trying to reach have moved, and some of them have moved across state lines. And remembering who people are across 2, 4, 8, 12 years is a big challenge for any organization that is trying to maintain institutional memory across a number of years like that. But if you assume that that information from a conversation in 2008 is still attached to the voter that you're talking to, you know, you're going to want to have access to it.
Now, before we let you go, Ethan Roeder, we should point out that a big part of the dispute here between Sanders and Clinton and even the Democratic National Committee, a lot of it has to do with your work, right? Because the Obama campaign, famous for the depth and breadth of its email outreach and its database, turned a lot of it over to the DNC a couple of years ago. They have your data, right?
during a primary, it's incredibly important that you separate the information that two or more competing primary candidates are generating. But after the primary, it becomes very valuable for the party to have access to any of the information that any of the primary candidates collected. And that's the case on either side of the aisle.
Well, then, is it fair to say that Ethan Roeder is the brain of the Democratic Party right now, considering that you're the source of the institutional memory?
Well, I've certainly always thought of it that way, but I'm not sure you'd find anybody else to agree with that statement. But you know what? I'm glad you put it out there.
Ethan Roeder was the national data director for the Obama campaign in 2008 and again in 2012, the campaign that turned over its vaunted and celebrated database to the Democratic National Committee. Ethan Roeder, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have liftoff of Falcon 9.
That is the sound of a successful launch from Cape Canaveral last night. But the bigger news wasn't the launch. It may have been the landing. Falcon 9 rocket launched at 8:29 p.m. Eastern Time and then gently touched down just 10 minutes later, courtesy of Space Explorations Technology Corporation, otherwise known as SpaceX. Joining me now, Miles O'Brien, science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Hey, Miles.
Hello, Todd.
Well, walk us through what happened when SpaceX launched and then turned around and then landed again last night.
Well, for one thing, SpaceX did its primary mission, which was deliver those communication satellites, 11 of them, from Orbcomm. That was the primary mission. The secondary mission was the cool one, which is what we saw. It's like a 150-foot-tall broomstick with fire sticking out the other end, landing exactly on a bullseye at the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station there. It was an amazing sight to see. They've tried it before with limited success. This time, a perfect 10, even from the Romanian judge.
Now, it was really fantastic, the takeoff and then sticking the landing, Miles O'Brien, but I felt a little bit bad for Blue Origin, who on November 24th did pretty much the exact same thing. Jeff Bezos is involved in that.
He did. It was a smaller craft. They didn't attain quite the altitude, but they did do the same feat. This is not easy stuff, and we should give both billionaires plenty of credit here. I say more the merrier in space.
Yay, billionaires launching things into space. But what does this mean for the space industry? I mean, being able to launch a craft and not have it just splash needlessly into the ocean or burn up on reentry.
Well, less litter, for one thing, but more importantly, we're talking about the possibility of true reusability. This was something the shuttle tried to do with really not much success at all. If you can reuse the significant pieces of your rocket, it stands to reason, and you do not have to be a rocket scientist to understand that it could be cheaper over time to get to space. This is what Elon Musk is after, and in the space world, what he accomplished last night is a big deal.
I've always wondered, Miles O'Brien, why it's better or more cost efficient to turn the rocket around, fire retro rockets and land sort of feet first than to just plummet back to Earth with parachutes and recover that way. Why is this better?
Well, you cause damage when you do that. You know, as you know, the solid rocket boosters on the space shuttle did just that. They went down under parachutes, ended up in the drink. It was a significant amount of effort to pull them out of the Atlantic Ocean, tow them back in, and then refurbish them. Salt water is not a good thing. So taking parachutes and bringing a craft down and having it land without any damage is a tricky thing. So instead, putting a little bit of extra fuel in, turning the rockets around, and sending it down as they did is really ideal.
NASA's watching from the sidelines here, of course. Is this the wave of the future for an agency that's going to want to be able to launch but save money at the same time?
Well, that's why they've hired SpaceX to deliver supplies to the International Space Station, and that's why SpaceX is in the running to ultimately fly NASA astronauts to the International Space Station. NASA wants to get out of the business of low Earth orbit, move aside, let the private sector get in there, see if we can make a business out of this, and Messrs. Musk and Bezos are doing their best to prove it can be done.
And then part of the other story here is that if NASA can get out of the business of low Earth orbit, let these guys do it, it can concentrate on the big trip, the one to Mars, and that's the one we ultimately want to see. So maybe this is a chapter in that book, Miles O'Brien from PBS NewsHour. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Todd.
In an era of all things digital, you might be surprised to learn that Americans still buy about 1.6 billion Christmas cards every year. Yesterday was the U.S. Postal Service's busiest day of the year. Now, the tradition of sending out holiday greetings to family and friends dates back to 1840 when, and I know you all will tweet me if I get this wrong, a Scottish man named Thomas Sharrock produced cards with the caption, "A good new year to ye." 3 years later, in 1843, English civil servant and inventor Sir Henry Cole commissioned an artist to create 1,000 engraved cards with the message, "A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you." He did it in British, of course. The rest is history. Ellen F. Brown is co-author of Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind, a bestseller's odyssey. She writes about literary and publishing history and recently researched the history of the Christmas card for JSTOR Daily. Ellen F. Brown, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
That number at the top, Ellen F. Brown, $1.6 billion, is surprising. I think a lot of people would think that the Christmas card on paper is dead. It's not.
I was surprised as well. When I started the research, I thought I was going to find some shocking numbers about the sad demise of this old tradition. And frankly, it's going strong. Not as strong as it has been in the past, but it's doing well. People are clinging to the idea of sending Christmas cards.
You've said that the American tradition of Christmas cards was what you called the work of kinship, keeping families in touch once they started moving off of farms and spreading out to the cities.
That's exactly right. After the Civil War, the demise of the family farm and also industrialization led to many people moving to cities. Families became far-flung. People weren't able to keep in touch. We didn't have telephones where we could just pick up and call everybody. So Christmas cards became a nice way for people to remain in contact with their extended family members.
How has the art on commercially available Christmas cards changed? I was surprised to learn that it's actually been pretty controversial, and people used to take the time to criticize the art that was on cards. That is, sometimes they didn't like it.
That was one of the things I was most surprised by this research. Found numerous examples of in major newspapers and magazines, people who critiqued Christmas cards every year. When the major printing firms would come out with new cards, people would go to the trouble to evaluate that year's take and say, which ones were the best ones? Which ones were shoddy? One thing I found interesting was that people then were already getting tired of some of the commercialized images of the holidays. It was so extreme back in the day that people thought that the Christmas card tradition would not last towards the end of the 1890s. They said it was going to be dead by the turn of the century, that people were going to get tired of this, and people wanted to go back to more sincere, I guess, individualized notions of greetings and that sort of thing.
So why did it last? I mean, there's two strains here. There's the fact that the commercialism lasted, and I think, you know, that was pushed hard by greeting card companies and everyone else for that matter. But this tradition should have died out with the telephone, and it didn't.
It didn't, because the industry has been very savvy about one thing. They have embraced technology time and time again. And even when other technologies were coming into play to make their industry seem less necessary, they adapted and made it easier for people to stick with this tradition. And I hear a lot of people saying that they're getting back into Christmas cards after they had left for many years, because it's so easy now to produce your own personalized Christmas card and have a little bit of fun with it. Whereas I think for many years, it was sort of viewed as a chore for people. It's gotten to be kind of fun again, and it's easy to do something silly with your dog, or, you know, even people who don't have families are doing Christmas cards. Anybody can participate in the tradition. It's no longer just for traditional families. And that's another thing the Christmas card industry has done, is they, not only can you personalize your cards, but they do sell pre-printed cards that appeal to a wide array of audiences. They even have Christmas cards for atheists now. So, and of course, and they include all sorts of different religions now. It's a holiday card. It's not just a Christmas card.
Well, war on Christmas, forget it, because this battle for Christmas or the holidays is going strong. 1.6 billion cards being sent out this year by Americans. Ellen F. Brown, who wrote about the history of the Christmas card for JSTOR Daily. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Charlie Hebdo, a satirical magazine, has been attacked before.
We're actually beginning to establish a relationship with Cuba that I think can be helpful in a number of areas.
In all the countries of the world, they're looking at the Syrian people like they are terrorists, or they're like bad people. All we want to do is just find a new place that we can learn the language and be a productive citizen and start to work.
Our daughter now has her parents married in every single state across this country. Is a big deal. It's an emotional day.
We have reached an agreement on the Iranian nuclear issue.
Nobody just gets upset at a party, goes home and puts together that kind of an elaborate plan to come back and do that. So there was some planning that went into this.
The hospital was repeatedly hit, both the front and the rear, and extensively destroyed and damaged.
Welcome back to the show. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. We've been rounding out our year with a series of conversations on everything from the economy and politics to arts and medicine. Jason Cohn has been with Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, for more than a decade, and he became executive director this past June, a few months before the deadly bombing by U.S. forces on their main hospital in Kunduz in Afghanistan. John Hockenberry sat down with Jason Cohn to talk about how world conflicts are shaping the program's mission and if Doctors Without Borders has to find a balance between epidemics and war zones.
There is very much a mix, I think, within our programs. Really the core bread and butter of our organization, which is being at the heart of conflict. Some places have obviously been more difficult to reach, like Syria, but also treating these diseases that are really killing people oftentimes as much as the bullets and bombs that are flying.
How did the Kunduz situation this year cause you to fear even more for the personnel that you have in harm's way?
Well, unfortunately, we have kind of a grim update to make on that. In fact, the casualty toll is now has gone up to 42 people. So we had 14 staff killed, 24 patients, 4 caretakers. So it's the largest loss of life for our organization in a single incident, an airstrike. What I think has been most destabilizing for us is that the Kunduz Hospital had been there for 4 years. It was really kind of an oasis in an otherwise unstable area where you had people being treated from all sides. And even in the days leading up to the bombing, we had Afghan army forces who were wounded who retreated there, later Taliban. And in the mix of that, people just caught up in the crossfire, civilians, men, women, children. And so it was a bit of a shattering of our sense of security, I think, in the sense that we had done everything we could in terms of being in touch with U.S. forces, NATO, Afghan opposition forces in the Taliban. When they took over the city, some of their commanders came to our facility, told us to continue our work, did not enter the facility with weapons, respected our most basic provisions of just respecting the sanctity of the hospital and not interfering with the medical care. So to have it bombed in this way, it moves the ground beneath your feet. In those 2 months since the attack, we've seen two of our facilities struck in Yemen. And I think, as you're aware, in Syria, hitting hospitals and killing patients and doctors is pretty much part and parcel of the war. And we've had a facility that was effectively hit twice, a so-called double tap, if you will, where when the first responders came to pick up the wounded, they were hit again when they brought them to the facility. We're very much in a very difficult moment for healthcare workers around the world, not just MSF, Syrian health workers on the front line doing incredibly brave work are really in the crosshairs.
As you spend a longer amount of time in a country like Afghanistan, 4 years in the case of the Kunduz Hospital, do you run the risk of being accused of patching up enemy fighters and sending them out to rejoin the Taliban, and that almost anyone can make that claim, and then that claim becomes an argument for some officer to send an airstrike over the hospital?
What you're alluding to, I think, is really a moment that we're in where there are real questions about the respect for the Geneva Conventions, which, you know, as medical professionals in our organization, they're not supposed to ask questions about who they're treating. This is the medical imperative, their ethical obligations through a Hippocratic Oath to do their work. And we can't be in a position to determine who gets treatment, because that's a breach of our responsibilities. In fact, if we're working from the same set of rules, our staff would be guilty of a war crime, of denying care to anyone. And not providing it on the basis of the need alone. And so I think combatants are bound by those rules. We're bound by them as well. It's our duty to keep our facilities free of weapons. For us, it's as much about our security as anyone else's and our patients to ensure that our facilities are there just to treat the patients.
How important is awareness and making people understand what the nuts and bolts of humanitarian work is, particularly on the medical side?
It's critical. I mean, right now we have 60 million people who've been forced to flee their home because of violence or persecution. I think it's important, particularly in this moment, as we see an incredible amount of fear in the United States and elsewhere following the attacks on Paris and in San Bernardino, that we recognize the people that are trying to reach our borders, the vast majority of them, they are fleeing essentially a Paris every day of their lives right now. They're bombed consistently in Syria, in Yemen. We have people walking across Iran from Afghanistan. We have people who've been warehoused effectively in refugee camps from Somalis, who've been in Kenya for over 20 years, in Darfur, places we've forgotten about that are still very much at the heart of a war. And they're taking desperate measures, and their families and their children. It's not an easy step to have to take your children on a rickety boat to try and cross the Mediterranean. It is a last desperate act. Engaging the public, particularly in a moment where the fears that are perpetuating, that are bouncing around, are creating a situation where we're gonna deny these people who really need safety an opportunity to seek that.
Do you like this job?
Absolutely. I mean, I have the privilege of working with some of the most courageous and dedicated people that you can imagine. I mean, they are willing to put their lives at risk for strangers, people they've never met before. You know, they go to the field sometimes up to a year, sometimes longer, living in very rustic conditions. I've been with them in places like in South Sudan, which is in a brutal war again right now. You know, they are some of the most committed and inspirational people I have a chance to work with.
Next year, that map will shrink or grow larger, do you think?
Keep in mind, alongside the conflict, we're in a situation where there are still many millions of people who lack access to basic medicine, right? So you've got a situation where 50% of our patients who are treated for drug-resistant tuberculosis, they fail the treatment. We are seeing malaria in places in Sudan, in the Nuba Mountains, that we haven't seen malaria before. So you have adults who are getting malaria. Too many children worldwide who are not getting vaccinated against the most basic diseases, things we should be really wiping out. Then you have a newer vaccines like the pneumococcal, so to prevent against pneumonia. Those vaccines alone, because the costs that are conferred by these vaccines that are being sold at such high prices, means that the cost of vaccinating a child in a developing country is about 68 times what it was a decade ago. You have a million kids dying every year needlessly from pneumonia-related disease. So, you know, we have trends where you've got people caught in conflict. They don't have access to the kinds of medicines they need that we could provide them preventively with. And then you have attacks on medical facilities. So it's really a witch's brew of things that we see happening in the world today. That said, more could be done. We could be doing more, I think, in a lot of places if we had the access.
Jason Cohn is executive director for Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
And here's something to take with you today. It's today's lucky number, 79140. If you have that on your ticket, it'll help you win the biggest lottery in the world just before Christmas in Spain. It's called El Gordo, the fat one. And this year, it's worth 2.2 billion euros. That's $2.4 billion. Now, that lucky number appeared on 1,600 tickets, mostly sold in the southern beach town of Roquetas de Mar, where the lucky winners each get 400,000 euros, more than $430,000. I guess they take El Gordo and they kind of chop it up into little paquitos. I just hope it's tax-free. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, a website builder that provides domains, hosting, and website templates, all with 24/7 customer support. More at squarespace.com/takeaway. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.